Rick C here.
And, oh, Rick C. Yeah.
Oh. Oh, okay. Got it.
Pull back the curtain, I see. Thank you very much. And you've been away. Where you been, mate? Listen, I just wanted to tease the show before we do our important underwriters. And so the first half hour of Out of the Box today is going to be an open call-in, whatever you want to discuss, whatever on your mind, think you want to share with the community. That's going to be from the 4 to 4:30 hour. 4:30 to 5, I have our intrepid reporter and talk show host, Jonathan Jay, who has just returned from the Big Island and the protest there at Mauna Kea. He's going to come in and share some of the taped interview pieces that he did, and then we're going to be talking about his experience there and what's going on. And then I'm very, very excited. From the 5 to 6 o'clock hour, I have two of the top people in the state of Hawaii who are working on the program of restorative justice, which is really important, evolving thing for a more healthy community. And we will be talking with them from 5 to 6 o'clock and, of course, taking your calls around 5:30 to 6. So stay tuned. I'm Rick C., and this is Out of Box. I'm happy to be sitting in for Jimmy Trujillo today. And thank you, Dove, for doing the intro.
So, Rick C.
Yes,
Paul. We actually have a caller who wanted to make an announcement. You want to start off with that since he's on the line?
Sure,
just real
let's
quick.
Do that.
Okay. Let's see. Aloha, caller. You're on the air.
Sure. I just won't take too long. I just want to make an announcement. There's going to be some of us holding signs to in support of the protectors at Mauna Kea to protect the mountain, Mauna Kea. From 3 to 6 in front of the airport tomorrow at that intersection.
Oh, here on Kauai.
Yeah, here nice. On Kauai, there's going to be a number of us that are going to be holding signs in support of the struggle to protect Mauna Kea. It's going to be from 3 to 6 at the intersection at the airport, so anybody can join us. You know, there may be other people who are intending to do that. If there are, that's good. But if people want to join us and they have any questions, they can call me. My name is Ray. The phone number is 631-6748.
631-6748. Okay.
Yeah, right. And, Jonathan knows who I am as well. But I just wanted to call in to, let people know there are going to be others out there holding signs right here on Kauai at the airport intersection tomorrow. In support of the struggle at Mauna Kea.
Friday. You know what I caught that you said at the top, Ray, that I really liked? Instead of calling them protesters, you called them protectors.
Yeah.
I like that word that you used there.
Well, that's what they're calling themselves. I'm falling in line with that.
No, I love that. That's very cool.
Yeah. That's cool. I like it too.
Yeah, so. We're definitely gonna use that. That's really great. So awesome. Thank you so much for that. And as you know, from 4:30 to 5, we will have Jonathan will be in. We'll be talking about that. And feel free to call back later if you have other input.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ray. So that's Ray. He and other people will be at the intersection of the highway and at the airport there from 3 to 6 p.m. tomorrow, doing a sign holding in support of the protectors there on Mauna Kea. What do we got?
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
All right. Get that out of the way there.
Yeah, that's exactly how it flies. And if you want your views or opinions expressed on the air, this is the time to do it between now and 4:30 here on Out of the Box. I always like to give an open call in time, so if you have something that's on your mind, give us a call right now. And it's after 4:30. We're going to be going into more directed programming. 826-7771 is the number here at KKCR. And, Dove, hand me that card so I can... is this it? Here we go. Mm-hmm. And the toll-free number is 866-275-1112. 866-275-1112. If you're calling from off-island, feel free to give us a buzz.
We might want to run Wave Riders real quick here before we jump into the meat of the show.
Let's do that.
And our fun drive is coming up here. Just
nice.
Weeks away.
Nice.
And so we're looking for people to jump on the wave with their business. Here's a little info about that.
KKCR's Wave Rider program will make a huge splash during our upcoming spring membership drive. For a donation of $150, a brief message about your business will surf the airwaves during every two-hour program throughout our 11-day fundraiser. The spring membership drive begins Monday, May 11th and ends Thursday, May 21st. Early sign-up guarantees you the most airtime for your message. WaveWriter forms are available on kkcr.org or call 826-7774 for more information. Reserve your spot in the lineup today.
WaveWriter. So, Dove, what is the WaveWriter? It happens during the, I know it's businesses and it happens during the fund drive, but what's it all about?
Well, for your tax-deductible donation of $150, we will mention your business or anything you would like to say during every show during the whole drive.
Mm.
So it's actually an amazing value.
That's really sweet.
It works out to like, per mention, it's very low price for what normally... underwriting or would cost. So it's a great way to get your message out to there. Some people don't do it about their business. Sometimes they just say, I support world peace,
right?
Or
I love my wife
yeah. Or yeah, whatever, something like that. But if you have a business that's just starting up or one that you're trying to get the word out more about,
cool.
It really works well. So we usually get a lot of calls through the fund drive, people who hear about a business and they're like, they want to call and get, maybe they missed the phone number and they want information. So we're there for the whole fund drive. We'll give out information about your message or your business during the drive.
What is that phone number? Since you brought it up.
826-7774.
Right,
yeah,
great,
if you want to be a WaveWriter, we're taking them on right now. In fact, we're going to actually record our first WaveWriter list here. We already have quite a few businesses jumping on the wave early. The earlier you get on, obviously, you're right up at the top of the first list. And so,
We
start running. As soon as we start running it, you're good to go. You're on the wave.
So. Like surfing.
Yeah,
you caught it. Everybody get out of the way.
Right.
we open call-in time right now. And call in, share your support for KKCR, or just call in about an issue locally, internationally, nationally that means something to you, personally that means something to you. Right here on Out of the Box, I'm Rick C., and 826-7771 is the phone line here. Here's a few things that occurred to me this week. And, I always say I'm kind of more a person who likes international politics. I follow that. I'm intrigued by it. So a few of the things that popped up to me was the Blackwater Guards who... after the Blackwater, a security agency, a private security agency that was hired to perform security tasks in Iraq during the course of the Iraq War, they were accused many times of violating laws and human decency. And in one case, they had a major shootout. I think it was 8 years ago, three or four of the Blackwater Guards went through a court process, and this week they were found guilty, and I think that's really says something. I mean, there's a lot of faults that we have in our government, but at least it worked through the process, and now who knows what'll happen on appeal, but two of the Blackwater Guards got 30 years each in jail, and one of the Blackwater Guards got life in prison. So I think that says something about American justice system, and that doesn't get the phone ringing, nothing will. I think another thing that I found really interesting, so we have Republican Marco Rubio has declared his candidacy, Hillary too, I'll get to her in a minute. And Marco Rubio says if he gets elected president, he's going to reverse all the openness to Cuba right away, right when he gets in office. And of course he does it because it's a suppressive totalitarian government at XYZ that doesn't allow its people freedoms. Well, then my question for Marco is, if I had him in the chair next to me, and the chair is sitting here waiting for you, Marco, if you'd like, is what about China then? Would you reverse all of our openness, all of our trade, all of our relations with China that we built since Nixon went there back in late 60s or early 70s? Would you do that, Marco? I really like you to respond and tell me, if not, what's the difference? Do we have a caller?
We actually have someone that you scheduled to call in.
Oh, yes.
To interview with her.
Okay, great.
So here she is.
Hi, who's this?
This is Doña Lily with Kauai Art Tour. It's kind of an interesting Doña Lily with Kauai Art Tour.
Yes, I remember.
It's a bit of a funny segue from what you were just talking about.
Yeah, well, you know, that's how we got to roll. When you're doing open call-in on a radio station, you wherever it goes, you got to be ready. And what I always tell people, I say, look, you can call in about anything you want, but the one thing I cannot speak to intelligently is sports. You can call in and talk about your team all you want to, and I can say, yeah, those Dodgers are a great basketball team, but that's kind of where I leave it. But otherwise,
you just let them monologue.
Yeah, exactly. So speaking of monologuing, Doña, so you are heading up the art tour, which I'm very excited about. I'm planning to go all day Saturday.
Wonderful.
Give us a little snippet on that, and I know you're going to be on next week with Felicia talking about it more detail. But this weekend is the first one. Tell us a little about it.
Yeah. So basically, this weekend is the first annual Open Studio Tour that's happening from Lihue to Waimea, and then next weekend is from Wailua to Hanalei. Mm-hmm. And there are 39 artists that are opening up their studios. On this, it's a free event, and people can pick up free guidebooks or go to our website, kauaiarttour.com, and find the guidebooks online. They can, you know, take the tours with their phone. And they just basically drive around to the artist studios whom they want to visit, talk story, see the artists do demos. They can buy art if they want. And it's just a really great way to engage with the art community and the artists. And I understand that you've actually done some of these on the mainland, like not as obviously as an artist, but like gone on them, because I know a lot of people here on Kauai don't know what open studio tours are.
Well, you know, the one that I have been to a number of times that I just love every time is the Venice Art Walk, which is in Southern California, Venice, California. And it's just fantastic. Now, that one has an advantage in that you can walk from, you know, the studios. They're all within, you know, I don't know, 10 or 12 blocks of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a map and you just walk through. But to do this on Kauai, where there's such beautiful art and to have so much creativity here, to have the opportunity to go to people's studios and come right into where they are creating their work, I find that really exciting and very profound and a real opportunity that I can't miss. I can't pass it up.
Well, I'm glad you're so excited about it. That's why I'm hoping a lot of people, both residents and visitors, will be excited about the opportunity, because it is very different from, you know, an atmosphere of going on, you know, the art nights where the artists set up like a booth or even a gallery walk or something, because this is like, you know, where the artist is creating, like you said. And so I sort of dubbed it as where the magic happens, you know.
It's
a very different type of environment, and the artists are usually much more relaxed, and it's fun to see the tools that they use, and, you know, sometimes you get to see stuff that they wouldn't necessarily have, like if they're an artist that has work in a gallery, you get to see stuff in their studio that they don't show outside because it doesn't have an audience. Like a lot of galleries have certain things they want to show, and they won't take other, you know, series of work. Like you might think one artist might only do paintings when in fact they also do sculptures, but you've never seen them because they're not shown outside their studio.
Now, here's my story for that. I went on the Venice Artwork one year, and I went to this, I forget his name is Michael, I can't remember his last name at the moment. He is a very well-known, highly respected artist in Southern California, and has worked for a lot of, you know, Hollywood people, and he does portraitures, but in a very unique way. Mm-hmm. And so I went to his studio, and of course his pieces are selling for thousands and thousands of dollars. I walk in and I'm looking around, and I saw back up on a shelf back in the corner these two small figurines. They were like busts made out of layered plywood is how he does it. And,
and
they're all up there, and they weren't even on display. And I said, well, what are those pieces up there? And he came over and he said, oh, those things, I don't know, I haven't looked at those for a couple of years. And so he pulls them out and he says, oh, you know, do you like these? I go, man, those are awesome. It was a male and female figurine. And, you know, which I always love the yin and the yang and all of that. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, long story short, I bought them from him, and he touched them all up, made them perfect, and I got such a deal on them.
Wow.
And this man would say a really highly regarded artist, just because I happened to see something in his studio that he didn't even forget about those little. So the opportunity to see great art and of course to purchase it, and you know, or to know what you like, or you know, and what I'm doing, I'm carpooling with a friend,
which is great. Yeah, you know? I'm definitely encouraging people to share rides, you know, if they're wanting to go but they're not sure, you know, it's more fun to look at that stuff and talk about it with people you know anyway, rather than just going by yourself.
Exactly.
Hopefully people will be carpooling, and with, like I said, with the smartphone where you can do it with your iPad or your or your phone, it's great to have like a navigator.
yeah
there will actually be also like these aquamarine colored signs around the island, so if people get a little bit lost, they can keep their eyes peeled for those.
Okay, so now let's go back to the basics, and I want to make one point with that. So your website is kauaiarttours.com.
It's singular.
Kauaiarttour.com. Okay, now I went there last night in preparing, because when I go out for art events, I like to look at what's out there so I can prioritize my time, and I'll know what's most important to me and see what I like. You have it so set up. You just go in there and click on the first weekend, and you know, which is highlighted. You click on it, and it takes you to this pages of, shows you a piece of each one of the artists, and you can go down and say, I want to go to this one out. That one's not so much for me. Oh, I love this. Da, 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 da. And of course, you know, all but a couple of them were the ones that are high on my list. And so I encourage people just to go there. If nothing else, maybe they can't even go on the art tour, but they can go to the website, kauaiarttour.com, and to check that out. And
I appreciate your feedback on that. It's, you know, it's been a lot of work. I'm basically doing it all, the website, the guidebook, everything. But speaking of, if you're not able to go on the tour, you can actually see a sample of each artist's work at the Kauai Society of Artists Gallery in Kukui Grove.
Nice.
There's an exhibit up the whole month of April. So even if you're not around or you're working these 2 weekends, you can stop by the gallery. They're open 11 to 5 every day, and then 11 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. And that will be open up until the 30th. So I know there are some people who are like, oh, no, I can't do the tour. But at least you can see there. We have, I think, 2 to 3 pieces from most of the artists on the tour, so you get to get a really good selection there.
That's awesome. Sorry. My friend just walked out the door. Yes, I want to say yes, yes, and yes. So now let's just go back to the final point. You can give your contact information, but it is from Lihue to Waimea tomorrow?
Yeah. So, well, not tomorrow. Tomorrow's Friday.
I mean, I'm sorry. I'm so excited. I want it to be tomorrow. It's like Christmas.
I am glad you're so excited. That's great to hear much enthusiasm. And then you've actually, like, planned for it. You
absolutely.
Know? So Saturday and Sunday, the 18th and 19th, are studios from Lihue to Waimea.
Mm-hmm.
And they're open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. And you can just choose which studios you want, do them in whatever order you want. See some. You don't have to see all. If you want to, great. And then the 25th and 26th of April, which is next weekend, are studios from Wailua up to Hanalei. And again, it's from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m.
That's
and
really
people
great.
Can get, they can pick up guidebooks at Kauai Society of Artists, and they can also look on the website and find other locations that have, you know, physical guidebooks, or they can just view it online. There's those two pages I put up with all the artist info, but then there's also like a flip book widget where you can actually flip through digitally the guidebook. I don't know if you saw that. It's on the tour guidebook page or something.
No, I haven't.
And so you can flip through that sort of virtually if you haven't had a chance to pick up the guidebook. And
all
that has a little bit more information and
this
stuff
is,
on our sponsors
this is awesome.
And everything.
Yeah, and speaking of sponsors, it is a free event? Is that right?
It is free. I wanted to make sure that, you know, everybody could take it if they wanted. So the guidebooks are, you know, they're pretty well made, and people are kind of shocked that they're being given away for free. So it is free, and we have partial sponsorship from the Hawaii Tourism Authority, which is great. And then also Kauai Society of Artists has been generous enough to let us use the venue for the preview exhibit.
Wow.
And also the Hanatepe Economic Alliance as well.
All right. So the gallery where they can see the work is at Kukui Grove Shopping Center.
Yes.
The website is kauaiarttour.com.
Correct.
Is there any phone number, anything else that you, or they just want to head out? And the color of the signs they're looking for, if they're heading west or south and then west, the color of the signs are?
Well, actually, for the entire tour, they're all going to be sort of an aquamarine color.
Aquamarine, right.
So, you know, both weekends is the same color, and just keep an eye out for those.
That's
and
good.
Then if anybody has any questions or they need any, I think they, with the ADA, there's like disability stuff, they can write in kauaiarttour@gmail.com is the email. And we also have a Facebook page, Kauai Art Tour, which has a lot of fun pictures of, you know, we had an opening reception at KSA last week, and that went really well, and we have pictures of the artists with their artwork and stuff like that, so they can check it out on there. And we have Pinterest and Twitter if you guys are into social media, stuff like that.
Donia, thank you for calling out of the box today and sharing your with the
to meeting you next weekend at my studio, where Zoe will actually be painting one of her surfboards, which is pretty awesome.
I will be there. I can't wait to shake your hand.
Okay, thanks. Take care.
All right, thank you, and aloha.
Bye.
All right, phone lines open again here, and I've got a new man in the chair. I've got Jonathan Jay here sitting in, helping me, being an engineer, and then I'm going to interview him. This is kind of turning the tables, you know. He's on the other side of the big microphone, and he has a little tiny microphone this time. But he's good enough with that. Anyway, 826-7771. Again, at 4:30, we'll be talking with Jonathan about his recent trip to Mauna Kea and what's going on over there. So if you have something you want to get out on the air, now's the time to do it. We have about 7 minutes left here in the open call-in period on Out of the Box. Let's see. What do we got here? Oh, yeah. So, okay, I was talking about Marco Rubio, and then Donia calls. I don't know. So maybe, here we go. Maybe if I talked about Hillary, let's see who will call then. What is the deal? I mean, why is no one running against Hillary? She ran as the presumptive candidate in 2008 and then got beat. She wasn't that good of a candidate. So how is it that no one is stepping up to run against her now? I'm just kind of blown away. Anyway, so sure. Okay, we're going. Hi, you're on the air.
Well, you know that you know what walks and you know what talks.
I do, but I can't say it on the air.
I know. Well, it's just I hate to say it, but each year America gets worse and worse and worse. The concentration of money at the top, the fact that real wages have not risen in 40 years, and then it's just like this whole thing about quantitative easing. I mean, most Americans don't have a clue that they're being sold down the river in extreme measures. I mean, how would you like to go to the bank and be able to borrow X amount of dollars for 0% interest? And that's what's been happening. But of course, we're not.
You mean by the banks and the wealthy individuals?
Yeah. So the point is, it just that's why. And then what most people also don't understand is that under the great Obama and all those other wonderful leaders we have of both parties, or actually one party, when Obama came in, they've increased since that time the money supply from $800 billion to $4 trillion. They've just been printing money to generate the funds to do the quantitative easing. Now, basically, the bottom line is that our money becomes worth less and less every day. And pretty soon, because of the derivative factor, which is a bet upon a bet, our money is going to be totally worthless. That's why you better get a bunch of, heritage seeds and learn to live off the land. And, not rely on the almighty buck, regardless of whether you're making a salary or not, because, the cookies are going to hit the fan. If it's not tomorrow, then in a few years. So the more self-sufficient that you are, the better positioned. So you can't really rely on money. And I don't know, America used to be a really fairly decent place, but each year, I hate to say it, it gets worse and worse and worse. And Hillary is a centrist. She is backed by the big Wall Street money. And
she has a track record of all that.
Yeah, and the whole thing is, I mean, yes, it was a fortuitous event that Mr. Clinton, yes, we did quite well because the dot-com phenomena happened, the tech thing. Of course, with the bubble, even given that thing, you know, people, I remember those people like those clowns getting on, oh, well, the new model doesn't involve profits. Really? So, I mean, you know, there were discrepancies in that whole thing, but the thing is, when you see the average poor person, I mean, I remember back in the 50s when it only took one person to support a family. And I'm talking about someone like who's like delivering milk,
right,
or
sure,
working in a factory.
Sure.
And so I just wish things would change, but I doubt that it will. So I would suggest people go to Island Breath and check all the self-help sources that are available. Juan Wilson does an incredible job in, you know, helping out folks, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's really interesting to watch Hillary's campaign. And I must say, you know, I kind of enjoy the whole strategic aspects of how you set up a campaign. That's a whole public relations issue, and I'm kind of fascinated by those things. And watching her start her campaign the way she is actually really genius. Now, it's totally insincere, but it's as far as being manipulative, campaign, and that's what campaigns are all about, or manipulating people to get to vote for you.
Well, you know, she was a Goldwater girl. She was a Republican.
Goldwater girl.
She was, yeah, she was a Republican when she was a young girl. And, of course, then she glommed on to the anti-war thing. She's a smart person, you know, so, you know, she followed that. I'm not saying she doesn't have a conscience. I met Hillary when she came here. I was standing in front of Suyoka's, and I gave her the shotgun. She goes, oh, I like that. So, but the point is, you know, I mean, she's very smooth, but whether it's, you know, Mrs. Republican or Miss Democrat, these people, all they do, they love power. They're sick. They're like the people who run for office. They're sick people. We don't need them. We don't need leaders like this. We need ourselves, to rely on ourselves.
Well, now, here's the people that I will wrap it up with this. My point is, I would like to see, I mean, not only Elizabeth Warren, of course.
Right,
I don't
on.
Think she's going to run. Bernie Sanders, I hope he does, because at least, you know, if Elizabeth or Bernie runs, even if they can't get elected, and I'm not sure they can't, but that they could bring a lot into the discussion of the campaign. And then the other person who I've learned a little about and very fascinated by is Sherrod Brown. And I'm trying to remember, he's a senator from
Maryland?
No, it's not Maryland. It's a middle country state, and the guy is awesome. He's amazing. So anyway, so there are other people. I hope they will come to the table. I appreciate you coming to the table here on Out of the Box.
And the last factor I'd like to mention is that most Americans don't understand that during our height of involvement in the Iraq War, we had over 100,000 private, you know, security folks like Blackwater. We had more private folks, you know, than actual troops. And no wonder we pushed the national debt to $18 trillion.
Yep. And speaking of that, and then I've got to cut you off, but
yes, sir.
I just heard today on National Public Radio that Ben Bernanke has now moved over to take a job on Wall Street. So there you go.
Well, why did Ben say, you know, we're having this irrational exuberance? Why didn't he, like, you know, give us a shout-out and explain all that?
Because it's all about corruption, as you said. Thank you for your call. Appreciate
it. Okay, have
your
a good
time.
One.
All right. Aloha. So there we go. All right, closing the open call-in half hour this time on Out of the Box. I'm Rick C. This is KKCR. And you're listening to us on maybe 91.9 on Kauai, or we don't have the frequencies. Oh, here we do. Yes, we have 90.9 Hanalei, 91.9 FM Islandwide, 92.7 FM Anahola and Molawa'a, and 104.7 FM Oahu, and 95.1 Cable, KKCR.org. So I'm moving into another segment. It's going to be really great. late breaking news from the Big Island, from the protests, or well, the protectors over there on the Big Island. Very excited about that. Our intrepid reporter here from KKCR and part-time talk show host, Jonathan Jay, is going to be my guest in just a few minutes, and we will be talking about his experience there up until 5 o'clock. And then, again, I'm very excited. 5 to 6 o'clock, I'll have two of the movers and shakers in the movement for restorative justice here and in Hawaii and around the world. It's very, very exciting and really beautiful new way to deal with issues. Anyway, Jonathan, we got some music there? Okay, here we go. We'll be back in just a minute.
How would they feel with a smile, be content for crying for the pains of USA? Now cry for our God, cry for our people, cry for our land that was taken away. And then, yeah,
I'm guessing this is recorded on the Big Island.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Nice. Wow, very nice.
From the front lines of Mauna Kea. This is Jonathan Jay for KKCR and Hawaii Independent Media.
Yeah, so happy to be back in the studio, back from Big Island. It's really an amazing trip.
Great. We're looking forward to hearing all about it. You brought some recordings of some interviews or statements you got from people. Tell us a little about that. Lead it in, and then we got about 10 minutes of that to share with the audience.
Yeah, there's more audio than I could possibly share with you. So so what I want to try and do is just go straight to that as much as possible.
Great.
And have as little as me. This is a little segment from Lana Kila. So one of the primary organizers up there is a young guy, 28 years old, and he's talking about what recently happened on UH Manoa campus.
Almost 1,000 people at UH, and they actually, in honor of the mountain, they built an ahu, an altar, on one of the lawns at UH Manoa, the University of Manoa.
Right.
There was a human chain almost over a mile long, passing the stones from one of the rivers.
Old
they
school.
Passed every single stone down this human chain all the way there, and right. They constructed the altar and they blessed it. And that is where now is the symbol of the mountain in Oahu.
Right.
And that is where they're gathered over 1,000.
And also, like, this process is supported not only by religious Hawaiians, but like Hawaiians who are like also believe in Christ. It's like more Hawaiian issue, not religious issue.
Well, as soon as we find it's actually not even a Hawaiian issue.
It's a human issue.
It's an issue for people who live on this land. Yeah, because you know it affects a lot of things. For some people, it's not this. They don't have that spiritual connection to the mountain, but they care for endangered species. A lot of endangered species. They care about open space lands. They care about nature conservation, or they just care about the law being upheld, because the law is not being upheld. So there's people are in this for different reasons,
and they're all good.
That's why for us, hey, anybody, and some people just love the mountain and would hate to see more bulldozing up there. And Hawaiians right now, because this is our place, you know, of course, we're one of the strongest forces here. But again, yeah, like you said, there's many Hawaiians who maybe they still don't follow the ancient beliefs, but always still have a heart and connection to the mountain.
Right.
So,
do you think like local?
So yeah, maybe I should go back a little bit and maybe go back
set it up
start
a little
to
bit.
Zero. Yeah, yeah. It's at this moment, for the last 7 or 8 years or so, there's been a large, well-financed international consortium of educational institutions and individual nations, Japan, India, Canada, several Caltech big universities in California.
Sure.
It's one of those large, large-scale financial institutions. Altogether, they want to have a $1.4 billion observational facility on top of the mountain. Now, they call it a telescope, but, telescope, this is not your grandfather's telescope. And your grandfather's telescope maybe is a couple of feet long, you know, maybe like the size of a baseball, and you point it and look at it and go, wow, look at the moon, Grandpa. Oh, that's fantastic. This is, they call it the TMT, and that stands for the 30-meter telescope. And people go, in America, they go, oh, well, 30 meters. I have no idea what that means. What it means is 30 meters is approximately 100 feet. And so that's describing the diameter of the primary mirror.
Oh, that's the diameter? I thought it was a length.
No. It's the diameter. Yeah, no.
Grandfather's.
No. The primary mirror in this telescope is 1.5 times the size of an NBA basketball court.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and it's not just the telescope itself. It's the entire support facility. It's the parking lot. It's the conference area. It's the, I think they're going to have some kind of, visitor center, a media center. It's like a 5 to 8 acre facility up on top of the mountain. And in fact, it's interesting. There's this facility, the TMT facility, is so large that there actually isn't even room for it on the top of the mountain because, as many people know, there's already more than a dozen telescopes up there. So there's no more room actually on the crown of the mountain. This is going to go into over the top into the far side, literally over the top, because that's the only place left on the mountain where there's enough room to build an 8-acre facility. And it's going to be a 20-story building. They're going to blow the ground up 4 stories down into the ground to make a foundation, and it's going to be 2 stories underground and 18 up above. So it's a massive multi-billion-dollar facility. And a lot of people say, oh, well, hey, what difference does it make if there's only one more telescope? There's already a dozen up there. This facility is more than twice as big as all of the existing facilities combined. So it's not adding one more telescope up to where there's already a dozen. It's adding 24 more. So it's really quite phenomenal. And so I have lots more audio here.
Well, we also want to be able to touch on, of course, that besides all of that, this is sacred land. It's a sacred mountain. So let's get into that at the appropriate time.
Let's go right there right now.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people were involved when this legal thing was playing out since 2008, but the support has really grown since Guardian phase took over, or I don't want to say took over, but began.
I think what our action has done is just brought awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now you had a big push of us getting here, and there was something that really resonated with people, and that the day of the arrests where people were willing to stand for the mountain, that really just gave that charge and reminder of people that this can be done. That, you know, the people have become so complacent, yeah, and worrisome and fearsome. But they don't want to make waves. So we end up just laying down and taking it. And then we just cry afterwards when it's all been damaged. So, you know, I grew up with that. I grew up watching all Kauai High get developed, Kona get developed. I watched it. I was a little kid. And I hear my parents' generation, our kupuna, cry. Oh, you know, they wiped this out. It's gone. We can't get down there anymore. Or they blocked us out. The fish are gone. The reef is gone. The trees are gone. You know, and because they were in that place where fearful to do anything. A lot of no hope. You know, no, don't even spend your time trying to fight that. They have all the money. What are you going to do? That kind of suppression. They're like, you have no say if you don't have the money to back it up. Then what's the point of being, you know, where's the human spirit gone? That's really what this movement is becoming, is reinstating spirit back into the people. I had an elder talking to me one time, and he really said, we're back in a time where we need heroes again. We need that spirit back. Because other than that, it's like the Matrix. No, they just all got us running the rat race. Not going to question the system. Just do your job, pay your bills, take some of these things that make you feel happy, and stay doing what you're supposed to be doing. Shut up. Don't talk back. Don't question it. And we're just like, no. I'm like, no, we're not going to be bound to. And that's not, again, this is just an example of what's happening in Hawaii. But this is happening everywhere.
So, Jonathan, now where was that recorded again? And who are we hearing there?
That was the voice of Lana Kila, and he's 28 years old. He's a hula performer and teacher, educator. One of the things that's so amazing to me about this young man and so many of the other young people, they're in their 20s and 30s. I talked to somebody who is as old as 44. That's the oldest person I could find on the mountain. But they all recognize that they're standing on the shoulders of generations and generations. They don't know what it was like to have been beaten for trying to speak Hawaiian. They don't know what it was like never to have been not allowed to dance the hula or to have their cultural practitioners. Because their parents and their parents before them already have fought those battles.
Mm-hmm.
Already have fought those battles. So you heard him talking a little bit about how when he was a kid watching development happen on the Big Island, places that are lost, the reefs are lost, the access here is lost, the trees are lost. And, these young people who have grown up in both worlds, yeah, in the Hawaiian culture that's been reemerging, and then also in the global culture that we're all a part of, they're not going to take it anymore, but it's really invigorating and exciting and inspiring to see them step up, not in anger, but in compassion and with patience and with love. But the thing that's so inspiring to me about these young people, and Lana Kila in particular, is they're educators. They teach kids, and you can tell, you can hear it in the softness of their voice, because they can explain things so simply that even your kids can understand. And that's a big that's really helpful today, because we have so many adults who are so dumb. And it's not their fault, but they have so much garbage that has been put into their minds growing up, very false ideas about what is right and what is wrong and what is sustainable and what is not and how to be compassionate. So that if they don't understand it, their kids can explain it to them. So it's really amazing.
So you got back on what day?
I got back Tuesday night.
Let's pull that pod down for we get a little buzz in the line.
Sure.
We'll pull it down while we're not playing it. Got a little buzz in my headset there.
All right, there we go.
A little better. So anyway, okay, so and this has been going on the Big Island now for 2-3 weeks?
Well,
Actively.
Sure. The big picture is back in 1968, the Hawaiian University of Hawaii got a lease with the state, gave them the access to the top of the mountain for $1 a year lease, and they started putting telescopes up on the top of the mountain, 40 years ago. And at first, they were your grandfather's telescopes, but they became ever larger and larger until, some of the largest telescopes in the world are on top of Mauna Kea right now. But this new telescope is twice as big as everything that is already up there. So, and a lot of people say, well, how can you never complain before? Why now? Well, enough already is what they're saying.
Well, do you have anything else for us to play?
Oh, I got tons of stuff.
Great. Let's hear another clip. And again, ladies and gentlemen, this is this is something really important to the culture, to the people here, and I'm hoping this may be a watershed moment. As
I believe that it is.
When I lived on Maui in the 70s, and the Hawaiians took back Koholawe. That was a turning shed,
yeah.
A turning point,
yeah.
And a watershed turning point, whatever it is, and then the Hawaiian language starting coming back,
yeah,
and
a whole renaissance began, yeah.
And that this is a place. I know there are negotiations going on, but we can get into some of that later. But go ahead, Jonathan. Let's go to another clip, please.
Sure. This is a real short piece from Andre Perez. He's one of the organizers there.
Any act of culture in occupied Hawaii is an act of resistance. Is a political act, yeah.
And it's fascinating. Let me go get you to another clip here. This is from a young woman named Caroline Nelani Henderson. She's a master hale builder.
The hale, or a hoi, an indigenous thatched house.
And I should say, this is something that they, just over the last couple of days, they just built. They just created a brand new hale. Up at about 9,200 feet, right across the street from the Hale Pohaku, which is the astronomical visitor center. That's where the majority of the people are converging every day. And so they're reclaiming the space, and they've just built a new hale. I'll let her explain that again.
is a house. It's a home. It's a shelter. It's a safe haven. It represents many things on that level. On another level, it also represents a claiming, saying, hey, this is my home. You know, you put up a hale, you're saying, this is my space. And so, to me, when we build hales, we're reclaiming space. We're saying, this space now is going to serve a cultural function.
Maybe it might be nice if listeners could know who you are, if you could introduce yourself and maybe say a tiny bit about what is your background and how you come to understand and learn about how to build these hale.
Yeah. So my name is Carolyn Nalani Henderson. I am a student or a haumana of a master hale builder whose name is Kumu Palani Sanensi. I'm an alaka'i in his halau, hale kuhi kuhi. And Uncle Palani's been building hales for the last 20 plus years. He's built more than 180 plus hale.
Oh, wow.
I don't remember how many I've built.
That's good. You're starting to build too many to remember. Congrats. Good for you.
So, let's see.
How old are you?
31.
31, okay.
I'm 31 years old.
And where were you born and where's your family from?
I was born in the mainland. And my family is from Hana, Maui. And then I was raised in Hana, Maui.
Can you describe to me some of the parts of this hale?
Yeah. Every part has a name and a function. All of the posts going into the ground, except for we didn't plant these posts into the ground to make a statement.
Why was that?
Well, the statement is that this is sacred ground, and that we don't want to penetrate it.
Gotcha, okay.
And we also want to make this portable, so that when the movement moves, we move. So, yeah, we're also saying, hey, don't drill up there. We're not going to...
So you lead by example.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you were asking me before what the hale represents, and I was saying...
You wanna make a comment? She's gonna continue.
I was just saying, sure. You know, here they are planning to go four stories down into the ground,
mm-hmm.
and she doesn't even want to penetrate the ground to set up her stand there, or whatever she's doing.
It's a hale. It's an amazing piece of architecture, and it's like a gigantic puzzle piece that goes together. Everything fits into everything else. It's really amazing. All made out of all natural materials.
So the way
that has been done. For 1,000 years.
And my point is that, you know, how can they think that they could be going four stories deep into the ground when people who have shared the love for the Aina and the culture don't even want to stick something a couple feet in the ground?
Because they have a fundamentally different worldview. And she makes this point really well right here.
The end justifies the means. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Saying that it represents a reclamation of space, I would add to that when we rebuild the way that our ancestors rebuilt, we rebuild our souls. We're rebuilding inside of us.
Mm.
We, on the outside, we're building something, and we cannot build something in and out of us alone. It has to be done as a community.
Lau Lima.
And so I feel like as we've been working on this and as we've been putting all of our hands and all of our energy into building this hale and building hales around, we're creating a rebuilding on an internal level. And so it also represents that.
Hmm. Is there any message that you would like the people of Kauai to, the one most important takeaway from what you're doing here specifically and in general?
Just that it's important that we remember who we are, and the way that we remember is important too, and that when we do things the way our ancestors did them, ourselves to their knowing, because the knowledge is in our DNA. And so when we begin doing what they did,
we awaken that knowledge that's already in us, and we become connected to them on a level that we hadn't before without the doing. And so the doing helps us to remember, the remembering helps us to do, and it all reinforces knowledge that's deep down inside of us that we can bring outside of us when we begin doing what they did. So there's an importance, there's a massive importance in doing what our ancestors did, even if we think, ah, who's going to live in a hale? Who's going to live in a hale? But it's important to build hales. And why is it important? It's important because our ancestors built hales, and we need to do what they do in order to know what they knew.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for speaking to me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks.
Very powerful.
Yeah, it's profound. And I got a chance to speak right there with, there was a father who was there with his two little, I think it was a little girl, a little boy, maybe like 3 or 4 years old, 2 or 3 years old. And this is what I had to, this is what I asked him, this is what he had to say about what he was experiencing.
Great.
So, when you were a Keke, when you were like 3, 4 years old, did you ever experience anything like this?
Unfortunately not.
But your Keke just do.
And I think that's why when we're getting back to like the question of is the Mauna a place for the Keke right now with everything that's going on, with all the Mauna that's going on. To me, because I didn't get to experience it firsthand, like this is their opportunity to experience it firsthand. And I think I would be selfish if I was uncomfortable with myself because I wasn't Hawaiian enough to face my Lahui, and then that's what kept me from being my Keke to be able to fight the same battle later. So, in a lot of ways, it's like repairing. I don't want to talk during the holiday.
Yeah, so it's you're saying you're hoping that it's like a rebuilding or another watershed moment.
Sure.
It is. It absolutely is. Mm. And people can feel it, and they can see it, and they can smell it, and they can touch it. And it's really, to be there and to experience it, it kind of shakes your whole being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just, this isn't a battle of ideas. This has to do with a fundamental understanding of our place in the world, of where we as human beings are and how we see ourselves in the world. It's really profound. It's really, eye-opening.
Well, I think one thing that's telling is that I hear no anger in their voices, and that's something that's kind of unique to protest, and maybe that's where they actually earn the title of protectors.
You ask them, you know, what are you protesting? They say, we're not protesting anything.
Mm.
You know, we are protecting the mountain.
Oh, very nice.
You know, they say, oh, well, what is this all about? I heard they were going to build a telescope up on the top of the mountain. Like, no, that's not what it's about. What it's about is reasserting the sacredness of the place and compelling that recognition.
Right.
Yeah.
4:54 p.m. here on Out of the Box. I'm Rick C. My guest right now is our alternate host here, Jonathan Jay. He's been just returned recently from the Big Island and hanging out with the protectors over there and doing a little protecting himself and sharing that with you here on Kauai Community Radio. That's what we do. And so we are going to be doing that up until 5 o'clock, and then I have a couple of great movers and shakers here in the state of Hawaii about the issue of restorative justice. And so hope you'll stay tuned for that. Jonathan, what else do we have?
I got two more clips I want to play you. One, this is Noe Wong Wilson. She's an educator at the University of Hawaii, and let her speak.
Let me just say, sure. Folks, we regret we're not taking calls right now. We have a very limited amount of time to have this part of the program on. Jonathan, no doubt, will have more next Thursday on his program. And this is a subject that's really dear to our hearts, and that we wanted to get this in there here today. So we ask that you understand that we can't take calls during this segment. We'll be taking calls about restorative justice in the next hour. Jonathan, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Noe Noe Wong Wilson.
My name is Noe Noe Wong Wilson, and I'm an assistant professor at Hawaii Community College here in Hilo. I'm also chair of Ho'olulu Council, which is the Council of Native Hawaiians at Hawaii Community College. And we are part of the Puko'a Council, which is the university system organization that serves as an advisor to President Lasner and the Board of Regents. It's really challenging. It's really hard to arrest someone or to stop someone who is coming toward you with an open heart. And you know that they believe all the way in their na'au that what they believe is right. And they have that aloha, and it's non-threatening. So what you saw in the media and the pictures of the police and the DLNR employees and the young makua up there who embraced each other, knowing what their destiny was, knowing that they were going to stand on the road or stand on the construction site, knowing that others had their jobs to do because they have to feed their families and take care of themselves. But they did it with love, and they did it with respect. Oh, and let me tell you this little story. A few years ago when Dalai Lama came to Hawaii, I was fortunate to meet him. I was fortunate enough to be included in the circle and to meet him, and I asked him a question. And the question was, because he was talking about peace and love to us, and that's what we had to keep in our hearts, and that's what we have to remember for the world, to make the world work. And so I asked him, I said, how do you love the people that have been oppressing you and your community, your people for centuries? How do you love them when you know that they've caused so much pain and things have been taken away, whether it's the culture, the land, the language?
Yeah, a familiar experience.
Yep. And he said to us, you cannot lay down when people are hurting you. You can't. He's not saying don't fight them. He says you have to stand up for what you believe is right. But you have to love the people and know that they're making the wrong decisions, but you love them because it's that love that is going to break that barrier, break that open,
and then
open
heal.
Up the communication and allow the world to heal. And so he's a living example of that. When I heard that, I thought to myself, he is talking about kapu aloha. And it's that magnitude of really understanding what other people are going through when they're talking about, you know, ideas that are not the same as yours. People who use angry words out of frustration because for that moment they don't have the language that it takes to express what they really are trying to say. And there's some certain things that we'll never agree on, so we don't argue with each other about, right? And that's kapu aloha. It's respecting, it's having that full respect. It elevates the conversation out of the mundane and into a whole different element, a whole different sphere. And when you do that, you can find solutions. You can find solutions.
Wow. Bringing in the Dalai Lama to the Hawaiian movement, it's awesome and beautiful. I think... that's great. What do you have? We'll wrap this up. And then, again, Jonathan, you'll be covering this, I would imagine, more fully next Thursday on your show. And you'll be taking calls and talking to people about it then.
The reason why I am coming in with the stuff that's not even hardly edited is because there was a moratorium that was called on the construction of the telescope by the governor, Governor David Ige, last week. And that is going to expire. The moratorium is going to expire on Monday next week, the 20th.
It was called for 1 week, and it was extended to this through this week.
Right. And so Monday, April 20th, Monday morning at black o'clock in the morning, the TMT construction crews, it's my understanding, will be heading back up the mountain again.
Wow.
And so what I wanted to do was to make sure that the words of the people who are involved in this process and that those words are carried far and wide so that anyone who hears more about what's going on and whatever sure. resonates in their heart, that they can take whatever actions in a timely way. Last week, at the first time, there was 31 people got arrested when they shut down the construction crews. You know, next week on Monday, maybe it'll be 300 people. I don't know. But it's one of the things, and I guess I'll kind of close with this for now, But, you know, some people say, well, this is an amazing issue for the Hawaiian people. That's true. But it's not just Hawaiians that care about the Aina. You know, I mean, this is Earth Day is coming up, yeah? And so this is not just a Hawaiian issue. This is a human issue. And people all over the world are responding to that, even if they're not Hawaiian.
I noticed, I was listening to a community radio station on the mainland the other day, and I noticed that someone called in about that and said that they were going to have a local protest in a small town in California with regard to this in support of the people there. So, Jonathan, thank you so much. Thank you for what you do for the community and what you're doing to bring this to the airwaves here on KKCR. That's what we're about, and we appreciate everyone listening. And we're going to be talking about restorative justice now in the 5-6 o'clock hour, which is upon us right here at KKCR.org.
If I could, I'd like to go out with this last clip.
Sure. Okay. And I'm just going to say, so you're listening to Out of the Box. I'm Rick C., and my guest right now, Jonathan Jay. We'll be right back with a couple of important people, Richard Turbin and Lauren Walker from Restorative Justice.
Okay. My name is Jody Krangle. I was born in the UK, and I've lived on the Big Island of Hawaii for 8 years. And today I asked permission from our Mauna Kea to come up here and show her some respect and support her as she protects us on this aina and as it floats down into the ocean and spreads across the land to the rest of the world. And I feel really connected to her and making sure that she is taken care of. And I wanted to share my aloha with her today, and that's why I'm up here on the summit of Mauna Kea.
Some people, it seems like they want to come here with their ideas from elsewhere, and they want to change Mauna Kea. How has Mauna Kea, how has it changed you?
She's enabled me to find a connection and find my inner warrior and protect myself and my family, and she's helped me grow and see the earth as it should be, as a sacred place that we are all connected to, that brings us back to what we came from, which is one. And that's how Mauna Kea has changed me. Yeah. And I think that's all I have to say about that. That's my message, and aloha, Mauna Kea.
Okay, there we go. Thank you again for that. So let's get to our underwriters, and we'll get our guests. Our guests have been trying to get in on the phone lines, and we've been busy here juggling a thing. Just Jonathan and I here holding down the fort today. Usually we have another person in here, so appreciate everyone understanding that. And I'm, again, so much looking forward to bringing this to you. And stay tuned to KKCR for more on this issue, what's going on. Something's very important to all of us who live here and love Hawaii and the culture. So stay tuned for more what's going on in Mauna Kea.
KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K224CQ, Moloa'a, K284AL, Haleiwa.
Neil Norman and the Hawaii Life Brokerage Ohana proudly supports GMO-free Kauai, agricultural biodiversity, and sustainable farming practices, such as community gardens, food forests, seed saving, and beekeeping. Malama Aina.
Announcing the return of the Tahiti Nui's Hanalei Luau, featuring 50 years of songs and dances as a tribute to their mama, Auntie Louise. Tahiti Nui, providing live Hawaiian music on Kauai since 1963. This family-style luau is every Wednesday, 5 to 7:30. More information at 826-6277 or online at thenui.com.
Kaz's Welding, island-wide mobile welding service. Home and commercial fabrication, auto and truck repairs, whatever needs welding. You can call Kaz at 346-9805 for more information or to hire his mobile welding services. Kaz's Welding proudly supports KKCR.
And you are listening to KKCR Kauai Community Radio. This is Out of the Box with your host today, Rick C. So far, I've been covering a number of issues and just finished with Mauna Kea, some of the events happening on Mauna Kea, the people protecting the mountain from industrial technological development. And the next segment coming up, Rick is frantically calling people right now. It's going to be about restorative justice. So if you just stick by for a minute, and we'll be right back with more Out of the Box. Thanks so much for tuning in to KKCR and sharing your afternoon with us here. I believe we got a caller who's just called in right now. Aloha, caller. Are you with us?
Yeah, Rich Turbin here.
Here we go. There we go. Rich Durbin, thank you for calling Community Radio. We are real people doing real professional jobs here. Can you tell?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's obvious.
Oh, ouch. You know? I don't know if I should take that.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's just bursting out of the telephone receiver.
Nice. Yeah. Very good. So Rich, and Richard Turbin is your name. You are an attorney, and you are the president of the board of the Hawaii Friends of Restorative Justice.
I am. Last time I checked.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about you. I mean, so you're making a lot of money. We know attorneys; they're all about money. So you know,
Not at all. That doesn't work. You know, that's a paradigm that doesn't work. I mean, I'm about helping people, and if I help people and do my job well, then, you know, the money, material things will take care of itself. So that's always been my philosophy, and it seems to have worked. I help out victims. I'm, you know, a personal injury lawyer. I represent poor, unfortunate people who have been injured or hurt in automobile accidents, you know, trip and falls, accidents of all kinds. You know, and especially medical malpractice, you know, people who are unfortunately have been victims of a bad medical situation. So anyway, that's what I do for a living, but I also like to do pro bono law and help out the community.
And pro bono is free law, which we're going to get into that in just a minute. And your work with the Hawaii Friends of Restorative Justice. I want to introduce our other guest, Lauren Walker. Lauren, are you with us there?
Yes.
Hi, thank you so much for calling. Really appreciate having you here on Out of the Box today on KKCR. Both of you are going to discuss today your involvement with restorative justice. And Lauren, just give me the thumbnail 60-second or less version of you starting out here on Kauai in your early adult years.
Yes, I lived on Kauai in 1975 for 2 years, and I went to Kauai Community College.
Nice.
And worked at the beach house for Bob French.
Awesome.
He's a bus girl.
Very cool. Very cool. You mentioned when we were talking last night that your daughter went to school in Kaloa.
Yes, yeah. She went to kindergarten and first grade in Kaloa.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, great. Well, glad to have you here on KKCR. It's beautiful to see people who come here are influenced and have roots here, and then go on and do great things in the world. So thank you for that. And then let's talk just really briefly. I just want to touch on your very, very interesting and unique story, which seems tragic, but here you are years later. You were savagely beaten when you were in your early adult life in Honolulu, and somehow that brought you around to becoming a lawyer and working restorative justice. Just give us again a thumbnail sketch of how did that happen.
Okay, it was just a bad situation. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and partly because of my own decision to drink 3 beers or something and not eat any food all day and go out the back door of a hotel in Waikiki. And at the time, I did live on Kauai and was in Honolulu to visit my sister who lived here. And a guy, it was an attempted rape, and it just turned into a violent attack where he basically was trying to kill me, murder me. He had 10 fingers around my neck. He punched me and smashed my face all up. And Anyway, he was strangling me to death. I couldn't breathe, and as I couldn't breathe, I just had one little gasp of air left, and my whole life just flashed before my eyes, and I was just like 23 years old, and I had my little daughter at the time, and I just, with the last breath I had, I said, I have a baby. And when I said that, the guy just, he let me go, and and I ran. And I ended up, a cab driver picked me up and took me to the Ilikai Hotel where the police and ambulance came. And then that spurred me to go to law school. I went back to Kauai. I got very depressed. I had a smashed up face. I was really young and had this smashed face. I couldn't work, had my daughter and got very depressed. So I went to the Lehui Mental Health Clinic.
Yes.
And I saw Dr. Harold Hall, a psychologist.
Wow.
Who talked me into going to signing up for college at Kauai Community College. And at the time, I was not a high school graduate. I had only finished the ninth grade of high school. But I had put myself through a Montessori teacher training course and had taught in a Montessori school and done that for about 4 or 5 years. But I still didn't have confidence. I didn't believe I was college material until... Dr. Hall made me sign up, and then I went to school. I didn't plan to stay in school. I was going to drop out, but I just loved it. I loved my teachers at Kauai Community College, and I loved school, and I went straight through. I finished. I went to Kauai for a year. I came to Oahu, went to UH, and then went straight to law school in Boston. And then after 7 years of college, after, Kauai and law school in Boston, I came back to Hawaii and took the bar exam at the Ilikai Hotel where I'd been attacked, where I'd been brought after that night.
Wow.
I was attacked. And so it was a really poignant. I was in a different kind of bar. I was taking an exam to get in a different kind of bar seven years later.
Well,
and
so
it really influenced me.
And so there you have it. I mean, somebody that, you use the term, I don't want to get into this deeply, but it occurs to me that you use the term, Harold Hall talked you into it. I think he saw the light in you. I think he saw something in you. And here was this man living on Kauai, practicing here. It's probably a relatively small practice. He saw something in you and put the spark in you, and you went on to do great things. We'll talk about that in a little bit. I want to get back to Rich. Rich, tell us a little bit about what is... the Hawaii Friends for Restorative Justice, or let's back that up even a little bit more. What is restorative justice?
Okay.
Can you define it?
It means a lot of different things to, other people, to, all people who are involved in it. But from my standpoint, I see, restorative justice as restoring or healing, the soul and spirit of those involved in the criminal system. I mean, let's look at the offenders, the people who are convicted of committing crimes, rather than just, punishing them. Or, they call it rehabilitation, teaching them a trade. How do you really, kind of change their soul or heal their soul and spirit? And that's restorative justice for the offender and then likewise the victim. I mean, a victim, such as Lauren was just, talking about herself. I mean, how do you restore the soul and spirit of the victim, somebody who's violated? And then, you have the families, you have the ohanas of the, of the offenders and the victims involved, a crime, a violent crime or a crime that really hurts another person and hurts society. I mean, it really impacts, the family of the offenders, the friends of the offender, the ohana of the offender, and likewise the victim. I mean, how do you restore and heal, their soul and spirits also. So, in a way, we're turning or we're seeking to turn the criminal justice system on its head, not totally on its head, because, the criminal justice system has been, all about punishment, for a long, long time. And of course, there is a role. I mean, there definitely is a role for punishment in our criminal justice system. but it cannot be all about punishment. It needs to be, in essence, healing society, you know, also. And I just, if I can digress, one more minute I want to think about what the present criminal justice system has done to our society. You know, the United States of America, the paradigm of freedom and democracy and liberty. Well, it's sort of a contradiction because the United States has the largest number per capita of people in the world who are presently incarcerated. And this has been going on for a long time. You know, I did some research today. There's, at the present time, there's 2,266,800 adults, you know, incarcerated in the U.S. federal and state prisons and county jails. In 2000 and at the end of 2011, it went down a bit in 2012, but it's back. But it went back up in 2013, 2014. I mean, that's a tremendous burden on our society.
So here's what I want to do. I want to get to a point, and Rich, if you'll excuse me, tell me, can you explain, one of you, the difference between a standard judicial process and a restorative justice process? And if you can tell me about, let's take Lauren's case, for example. Okay, so Lauren's case, Rich, that goes through the standard legal process. What's going to happen if they catch the guy?
Well, you know, if they catch the guy and they convict him, he's gonna be going to jail for, you know, a long, long, long time. I mean, that's a terrible violent crime. You know, assault, an attempted rape. I mean, that's a first degree, you know, capital offense. So that person is convicted, looking most likely minimally at 20 years. And the United States has the longest prison terms in the world. I mean, much longer than whatever country's in second place. You know?
Yeah, I was doing some research last night and looked at the man who did one of the most tragic serial murder events in my recent memory, and that's the man who, Breivik, I think was his name, in Norway. And after, he killed 68 people and 140 more were injured, and then there was 8 people killed downtown in his explosion, 200 injured. He got 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
12
mm-hmm.
years in Norway. So, yes, there's a little difference. I'm not qualifying
and
that as right or wrong.
That would be lifetime in the United States.
That would
be
electric.
Life without parole.
Yeah.
He's probably not going to get out of prison in Norway in 12 years, though.
I would think so. And,
no,
but,
he won't.
But without us getting into that, why don't we go, Lauren, why don't you talk a little bit about what the difference would be? And I don't know if it's troublesome for you to talk about your own.
No,
I painted your case as a scenario.
Okay, what would happen is the defendant, the guy who did it, would come to court. He would have a lawyer. The prosecutor would be trying to prosecute him, prove he did it. He would bring in witnesses, me. I would have to testify. The defense attorney. Well, this is if he doesn't plead guilty. First of all, most of these cases, almost all criminal cases in the United States, over 95% of all felony cases, the defendants plead guilty. They don't even have a trial. There is no conviction by the judge. It's all plea bargains. They all plead guilty.
Well, they plead down is what they do.
Yeah, but they plead guilty.
Yes,
they plead guilty. And there's not the trial is not what finds them guilty. It is they plead guilty, and it's a plea bargain system.
So
they do plead guilty. So in the rare event, if there is a trial and the witnesses come on, so if I was the witness, the victim in the case, I would be questioned by the prosecutor first, tell my story. Then I would be cross-examined by the defense attorney, who would try to attack my credibility. Weren't you drunk that night? You know, weren't you walking alone on the street or something? You know what I mean? Trying to find some, you know, did I know this person? Trying to create some lack of credibility with me, make me look like I'm not telling the truth. And I, you know, I was a trial lawyer. I did that. Everybody, that's what you do. You attack credibility.
So what I want to find out from you, Lauren, is what is the difference? What would, now so we know what that would.
In a restorative process, what happens is, first of all, the person is not, the person who did it is not, we're not like just threatening that person so that they're so afraid if they speak, they know that they are endangering themselves because they're going to put themselves in prison by what they say. Instead, and this is how we used to do it 1,000 years ago, Westerners, like all indigenous cultures today, have some kind of a talking circle, a restorative process in their culture. And we used to too. Westerners did too until the Norman Conquest came. And then when the Norman Conquest came, the king took over all of the conflicts and then the prosecutors. But before that, people would sit in circles and they would talk and they would be respectful and they would share and they would say what they did because they weren't under a hammer going to get punished or, you know, get their heads chopped off. And so there was more resolution. And so in a restorative practice today, so what would happen is it would be very respectful. All the people would be respected. You would not have a lawyer speak for you. You would speak yourself. It would be voluntary. You don't have to engage in this. If you don't want to meet the person that hurt you, you don't have to. This is a voluntary thing.
But let me get in here. If I'm hearing you correct, wouldn't the defendant, if you will, the predator, wouldn't that person incriminate yourself? Incriminate yourself. Would that not happen? And then say they go, oh well, you know, we don't want to do restorative justice, and now we've got on record he's admitting the crime.
Right. Well, we do it usually in serious violent crimes. They don't do it until after the person has already been guilty.
I see.
And so it's people who take responsibility. And actually, there's a lot of people who want to take responsibility for what they did and are willing to and want to make things right, which is what restorative justice is about. But we do use it for diversion.
Okay.
So there's been, especially with youth, kids, you know, kids do things, right? That's how you learn. And
right.
You do these, you make these bad mistakes. And so instead of a first-time thing, you can be diverted. And it's not – we've experimented with a pilot project here about in 2000, 15 years ago. It was very successful. We had over 100 juvenile defendants who were diverted from regular police and court processes to restorative practices.
Is that in Oahu?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, very good.
HPD. And we did show a we have less recidivism. We have less recidivism. You have less recidivism when you bring people together like this, when they meet face to face. And the recidivism we showed was that the kids who went through our program still did commit other crimes, but they only committed property crimes. The kids who didn't do this restorative stuff, they ended up more going into violent crime.
Okay, I wanted a little bit more detail, but briefly, what I'd like to find out is, what is the encounter like? Okay, so they're sitting in a circle. They're gonna speak for themselves, each person. And how does this work? Do they just try and talk their way out of it? Do they actually come from the heart? How does that work?
It's a facilitated process. You have a facilitator who is very well trained and experienced. Not just anybody. You don't just throw people together to do this, and you don't just throw anybody in there to facilitate it. You have people who are well trained in it, that understand the principles of restorative justice, our respect, responsibility, and relationship. And so the facilitator sets the tone, which is very respectful. The people also, in these serious crimes, the people are very well prepared. I spent months in a murder case that I facilitated in Washington State, in a prison, and I worked with the people, the man who was the murderer, and then the wife of the man who was murdered and his daughter. I spent about six months preparing those people, talking with them on the phone, reading letters and things like that. So there's a lot of preparation. Most of the time is spent on preparation. And then, so then when you go in, it's like a ritual, you know, people sit in a circle, people speak one at a time. I have never witnessed myself in all the years I've been doing this, almost 20 years, I've never witnessed anybody. Oh, well, actually I did one time. There was a kid who said he didn't do it. He didn't do the crime, and the facilitator hadn't really checked it out. Usually you only use restorative justice with people who admit they did it, right? And this kid didn't, he said he didn't do it. But then during the circle, when they were having the circle, the great thing that happened was the father of the boy, the accused assailant, the father told, it was another, he was accused of assaulting a 10-year-old, shaking this 10-year-old. And so the father of the assailant, when the assailant said, no, I didn't do it, the father went over to the 10-year-old and said, you know, don't worry. My son will never touch you again. So and that little boy was so relieved. You know, it didn't even matter that the other kid was saying he didn't do it. There was still some value in it.
You're listening to Out of the Box. I'm Rick C. My guests during this hour are Lauren Walker, who is just speaking, and we have Rich Turbin, who is the president of the board of the Hawaii Friends of Restorative Justice. Now, Lauren, you were speaking about, I want to get back to Rich in a minute, but Lauren, you were just speaking about the case that you worked on for 6 months with the wife, the daughter, and the whose husband was murdered, and then the murderer, and that I had interest to watch on your website, Lauren Walker, L-O-R-E-N-N Walker.com, last night. The clip that you did is about a 6-minute piece of that. It's very moving of that process with those actual people that was for the Oprah show. So I think that's very interesting. Rich, I want to get back to you, and I'll let the listeners know that we'll be opening up phone lines probably in about 10 minutes. We have a whole lot to cover here on this very interesting, complex issue. Rich, tell us a little bit about what does Hawaii Friends of Restorative Justice do?
Well, you know, it does what it says, and a shout out to Lauren Walker, my co-guest, who has really founded with the help of others the organization, the nonprofit Hawaii Friends of Restorative Justice, really runs our organization on a shoestring budget. I mean, you know, this is really an organization that doesn't have a lot of administrative costs, hardly any administrative costs at all. You know, not a whole bunch of employees that have to be paid. I mean, it works largely through volunteers who are, you know, kind of supervised and trained by Lauren and others. And I'm just very proud of the fact that we do a lot of good, you know, without spending, you know, too much money. We don't have to, you know, spend our lives doing a ton of fundraising. There are some wonderful philanthropic organizations who fund us, as well as, you know, small grants from the government and other individuals and governments and nonprofits. We do it, you know, we really do a lot of work on a shoestring budget. I think it's a good model. But in any event, for many years we were known as Hawaii Friends of Justice because besides working on restorative justice, which was the emphasis of the agency, we were involved in civic education. And it was really Hawaii Friends of Justice and Civic Education, because we had educational programs for the public about our justice system and the goals of our justice system. We try to enhance justice in the court by providing translators and interpreters for people who were involved in the court but did not have a good command of the English language. So, you know, we were working to really enhance the justice system as a whole. But the emphasis really was on restorative justice. And just recently, within the last year, we decided to change our name to Hawaii Friends of Restorative Justice, really putting the emphasis on what was our most important goal. And, you know, I want our listeners to understand that, you know, the work we do is not just to change the paradigm of our justice system from the get-go. In other words, turn it around from, the present, punishment model and make it more, a talk story thing between the victim and the offender. But we are working very hard to make the present model, the present system, work better and heal people better. For example, we work with the women's prison and we forget that there's many of the adults that are incarcerated are women who are incarcerated, and they're in prison and they have children, and they have children that they're responsible for on the outside, families on the outside that they're responsible for. They're pregnant when they're sentenced to prison, and they have their babies while they're in prison. I mean, it's a very, very difficult, complicated life for a woman prisoner. Quite different in many respects from men prisoners.
Rich, I want to get into how it's applied, how you all are restoring the, how you are utilizing the practice of restorative justice here in Hawaii. But I want to touch on a word that you said there, and without us spending a lot of time, because we have a lot to cover, I heard you say the word healing. And restorative justice and all is a format, it's a system, it's a process, but really, doesn't it come down to healing and, at best, sometimes forgiveness?
Yes.
And
yeah.
Either you or Lauren want to speak to that.
Yeah, well, Lauren, why don't you go ahead?
Let's briefly, please.
Okay, well, yeah, it is, restorative justice is, that's one thing I think that what Rich said earlier, nobody really agrees on a definition of restorative justice, except I think that
we can agree on the purpose.
Yes, that it's about healing. And it includes another thing Rich talked about, it's emotional healing, which a lot of times our criminal justice system doesn't really matter, All the criminal justice system is more interested in is punishment, identifying the perpetrator and then punishing them. So restorative justice is about healing. And the forgiveness that comes in restorative justice, you don't ever have to forgive anyone. No one is ever asked to forgive anyone, we even advise people, don't even ask for forgiveness, because forgiveness is a gift. It's a gift someone gives you, and you don't ask for gifts. But if it does come, like in the case that you watched, Rick, in Washington, where the woman whose husband had been murdered 7 years earlier, and she met with that murderer, that woman was so angry. She was so, her life was really devastated with the loss of
her
husband.
You could feel that.
And yes, she was really, really devastated. But then after she met with that man and she understood then that he was an alcoholic. He had been led into the crime by another defendant who didn't participate in the process. He was very remorseful. He was very sorry. He was really genuinely and sincerely just sorry. He had tried to kill himself several times in prison. And this woman at the end, if you saw the clip, and
yes,
you saw, she ended up, she said she didn't forgive him. And
she said she couldn't, she wasn't ready yet.
Right, she wasn't ready yet. But later on, she did forgive him.
But she gives him a hug at the end of their encounter. And she said, I can't believe I'm even touching you. And she was crying.
Yes.
And she was obviously so conflicted. And yet the process was very alive in her. I want to go to talking about how you're applying restorative justice in Hawaii. I know, and I understand you're working through with juveniles, as you said earlier, in the Honolulu Police, domestic violence, universities and business ethics, environmental applications of restorative justice. It's very, very encouraging to see this, especially as Rich, you pointed out so well, with over 2 million people in our country under lock and key, and with a very tragic environment that they live in, and the murderer makes that pretty clear. He's pretty dead in his emotions and his affect, in that clip. Which is again available on your website, Lauren, L-O-R-E-N-N, walker.com. Very moving clip, which was found on Oprah. Let's talk, Rich, let's talk a little bit about, and both of you, but Rich, let's start with you, with about how it's being applied and what you are finding for the application of restorative justice in the state of Hawaii. And we're going to open up the phone lines in 4 minutes here on Out of the Box.
Well, Rick, what I do want to say that we're also practically oriented, and what I was saying before, for example, in the women's prison, and you know, in Hawaii, restorative justice is helping women with the practical problems, making easing their minds and their emotions by helping, you know, with the child care, you know, while they're in prison, you know, helping them with their legal problems that they face, you know, medical problems for their children. So, you know, there's also, you know, practical services that we're giving. And then we're organizing circles for adult men who are released on parole. I mean, you just you just release a man who's been in prison for 10 years. It's going to be difficult for him to operate. I mean, that's that's understandable. But with restorative justice, we organize circles for the men to help them talk out their problems, to help them forge a better relationship with their families, with victims, but also with their parole officers. I've been fortunate enough to go to several graduation ceremonies for adult men who are graduating from parole. And their families, their ohana, come with them to the graduation ceremonies. There might be 50 people, 100 people sitting around in a circle. And, you know, we've been doing it at the Supreme Court, at the Supreme Court of the state of Hawaii. I mean, the most important court in our land. And the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the judges who sentence these individuals come and join hands with these recently paroled prisoners and talk about the experience that everyone goes through. It's really wonderful, and you multiply this several dozen times with all the other circles that the Hawaii Friends of Restorative Justice are doing within the state prison for men and the state prison for women with the juveniles. It's a remarkable process, and I've been personally extremely inspired at everyone that I've gone through.
Hey, you know, I want to ask the question. You keeps coming up. I hear this, and Lauren, let me direct this to you. The word circles comes up. Circles. I see this in a number of places when I'm reading about it. How circles are applied. How circles are not a format, but develop a system of communication. I want to remind you. I'm Rick C. I'm sitting in for Jimmy Trujillo again. Happy to be doing so here on Out of the Box on KKCR. Jonathan Jay is sitting in as my engineer tonight. Very glad to have you. Thank you, Jonathan. I'm speaking with Rich Turbin of the Hawaii Friends of Restorative Justice and Lauren Walker of much fame from laurenwalker.com. Lauren, can you speak a little bit about why circles are important?
Sure. When we talk about restorative justice, there's really two concepts that are very important to understand. One is that there's a restorative justice philosophy, which is what are the values of restorative justice? And that is very different from what our restorative practices. What are the practical applications of the restorative justice philosophy? And so the restorative practice that is one very common one is the circle process, which is all indigenous cultures today have some kind of talking circle. And just like in Westerners, like I said earlier, used to do these talking circles. And everyone knows, even right now in people, we know in Hawaii, obviously, we have ho'oponopono, which is a practice, a restorative practice that the native Hawaiians use. And other cultures have different types of circles, like the Native Americans have certain kinds of circles. in Africa, the ash circle. There's all kinds of circle processes. The circle is really symbolic. It is something that is, it's almost an innate thing when you think about it. The earth, our planet is a circle. The sun is a circle. All the cells in the human body are they're circular. The circle itself is a really symbolic thing. I just wrote a paper about it.
Well, it's also non-hierarchical.
Yes. Everybody is treated as an equal.
Yes.
Everyone is, you know, everyone is respected. Everyone is respected to share whatever they need to share. And that's another thing about restorative justice and restorative practices, that it's about healing and it's about meeting everyone's needs. What do you need when something has happened to you, something has hurt you, or when you've hurt someone else? What do you need? You need, first of all, the person who did it needs the opportunity. They need the opportunity to be responsible, not just scared that they're going to be punished and in trouble, but the real opportunity to express it and talk about it. You know, so often people just, something bad happens and we just like yell at the person who did it. You know, why'd you do that? Instead of, you know, what's going on with you? And seeking out that person's thoughts and feelings, and especially for the victim. That is how I got into this, because when that happened to me, when I was almost murdered in my early 20s, there was really nothing. I couldn't even talk to my friends. My friends, people didn't want to talk about it, and I didn't want to talk about it. You know, I felt the most prevalent feeling when you've been a victim of a crime, and also when you've committed a crime, is the human feeling of shame. Shame.
Yes.
It is, just even to say it,
yes.
You know, to say shame, that raises people's, you know, the Geiger counter, and our feelings, it goes off, because we don't know how. We don't talk about it. You know, we go see a psychologist, right? We go talk to
sure.
some professional. And so now I think the reason we restorative justice has come back is because the criminal justice system has not been effective in helping people deal with these really important emotions.
Well, I think the other thing, too, is that the criminal justice system and attorneys, you are attorneys, you know this very well. When you have a client, you say, keep your mouth shut, don't say anything. You know,
right, of course.
I'll handle
yeah.
everything for you.
That's
and,
right.
And so then the perpetrator may be feeling the shame. They may feel the guilt. They may want to admit it, but they
right.
know if they do, one, their attorney, who they got to trust, is handling the things in the only way we've had this system, the options. This is the only option we've had. You know, and that's why I'm very excited about having other opportunities. So let's talk about how this has been applied.
Okay.
We're working on trying to get a phone line open for our listeners out there. So if you just hold on a minute, we'll see if we can do that for you. But let's talk briefly about how this is being applied, maybe a story or two, but again, briefly.
Okay. We've applied it. Hawaii Friends of Restorative Justice has applied restorative practices more than almost anybody in the world, any organization. We've applied it to public housing communities, to juvenile justice areas, to court, to people after sentencing or when someone's being sentenced. What we do is pilot projects. We go and look for an area that hasn't been explored yet for restorative justice, and we apply it. And then we do research. And then we write about it, and we've published lots and lots of papers, probably about 40 papers on all of our work. And so we've applied it in all these different places. And like what Rich is talking about lately, in the last few years, we've been doing a lot of work with people who are incarcerated. And something that your listeners might be surprised to know is that, you know, the people, those 2 million people in prison in the United States and in Hawaii, that's not their first time in prison. This is sometimes their second, third time.
Right.
These people,
right.
They come in and out. We have a revolving door. And we have pipelines to prison. We have, and I'm sorry to say, but our schools are pipelines to prison.
Speaking of coming in and out, we want to yeah. give out the number and how to get into Out of the Box today. Sorry to interrupt you, but we got a lot to talk about. We do want to include the listeners, and we're going to ask you for concise questions for concise answers here on Out of the Box. I'm Rick C. Jonathan J. is my engineer today. Jonathan, what do we got here?
We have a brand new phone line for people to call in while we're
perfect.
working this out right now. So get a piece of paper, a pen, and write this down. It's 826-7814. Again, that's 826-7814 if you have a question or comment about what about this restorative justice conversation that's taking place.
826-7814 out of the box. We'll be here till 6 o'clock, but don't wait. If you got a question, ask us now. Lauren, go ahead and just wrap up what you were saying.
Well, I forgot what I was
okay,
saying.
Okay, well, you know, then let me move it into something else that I think is okay. Important. In Hawaii, people are familiar with, and there's deep cultural roots in a process called Ho'oponopono. And what is the relationship, if any, between that and restorative justice?
Ho'oponopono is a restorative practice. It's an indigenous. It's the practice of Native Hawaiians. Native Hawaiians use it, and it's a recognized restorative practice. Just like there are many all kinds of restorative practices.
So you're not necessarily having to sell your brand. You're selling the general outline and the values of it. We have a caller and a question for you, Lauren. Go ahead, caller. Hi, you're on Out of the Box.
Thank you. I think that's fabulous, the idea. I'm curious about attorneys who sit for the bar, B-A-R, exactly what that gives an allegiance to.
Sorry, it's a test. It's a test you have to take. And when I took it in 1983, it was a 4-day test. And you have to take the test and pass it. And then you get to, when you go into a courtroom, if you've ever been in a courtroom, you see there's a little fence. And the people, there's like a little fence, and the lawyers sit on one side of the fence. That fence is called the bar. And so once you've been admitted to the bar, you pass the test, you get to go through the bar, and you get to talk.
I see. Okay.
And I think the B-A-R stands for something British and the allegiance, and you can practice during good behavior. But if you're not in good behavior, which would be not abiding by the Constitution or depending on your oath of office.
Well, now, caller, I think you bring up something interesting, and I'm going to throw this to Lauren, then I do want to get back to Rich on a couple other things.
And let me just say, because I'm going to hang up.
Thank you, okay.
The whole thing is like, okay, you're sitting in a circle, that's wonderful, but you want to trust everybody.
Ooh,
how can you trust somebody whose allegiance is with the BAR, British, da-da-da?
Okay, and that actually works in tandem with the question I wanted to ask, Lauren, which is you call yourself a restorative justice attorney.
I'm a restorative lawyer.
The restorative lawyer, okay.
I'm a public health educator. I 20 years ago I switched careers from just being a lawyer, trial lawyer, to a public health educator. And that's another thing about restorative justice. It's a public health approach. To violence and conflict resolution. In fact, this summer I'm going to be doing 2 Fulbright specialist projects in Bulgaria and Spain on restorative justice as a public health approach.
We have one phone line open, 826. No, that's not correct. The phone line is 826-7814, 826-7814 here on Out of the Box. So if you want to get in calls, please do call us now. But let's get back to the caller's question. I think this is interesting. What about trust? Rich, why don't you speak to that?
Well, you know, trust is involved. You have to kind of set up a structure that's going to enhance trust, that's going to encourage trust. I mean, when you have these circles, for example, at the parolee graduations, you know, when you have the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, when you have the judge who sentenced the parolee to the prison sentence to begin with, you've got a structure that's going to enhance trust. And if, you know, families are involved, if victims are involved in that circle, they're going to feel protected. You know, when you have, correction officers, when you have, parole board members or parole officers there. I mean, these are officers of the court, officers of the system, you know, that's going to kind of create a structure of trust. Lauren and her other and the other developers and scholars, you know, of this treatment modality, restorative justice, I mean, they know how to do it. So trust is enhanced. And if I'm going to, if you don't mind me digressing just for a minute, I want to throw something else out there, Rick,
sure,
on a more kind of global basis. And that is, everybody in the know knows that our criminal justice system has broken down. It's broken. I mean, the prison system is broken. As a society, we just cannot afford to house, 2.2 million people at any one time in prison. We don't have enough money for that. We don't have enough money for, to both educate our kids and incarcerate these millions of American adults.
Rich,
this doesn't even count juveniles.
We have to just keep building more prisons, Rich.
Yeah,
with the program, man.
I just want to throw out recently there's been a project, an initiative started by the people on the far right of the political spectrum, the Koch Brother Foundation.
Yes.
I mean, those are the lions of the far right.
Yes.
Wing. Well, they joined together with the ACLU, which is the far left of the spectrum.
Whoa.
And jointly, they had a joint press conference, and jointly they have requested that drug offenses be taken out of the criminal system, for starters.
Wow, I'm wondering who's on drugs when they're saying that.
Yeah, so, I mean, the far right wing, the far left wing, everybody who has studied our prison system says, enough, it's going to break down. So you remove, the drug offenders out of our prison system, and they need their own sort of, restorative justice. And at the same time, as far as the violent offenders, you initiate restorative justice in that system, and these incarcerated people can get out of prison a lot sooner.
Rich, we want to go to a caller. I want to come back to and talk very briefly about the cooperation between the courts and restorative justice process and what you're finding with regard to cooperation. But we have a caller on the air. Hi, welcome to Out of the Box. I'm Rick C. Who are you?
Hi, I'm the caller. How are you, Rick?
Hey, good caller. What's up? What's on your mind?
Is Lauren? Can you hear me, Lauren?
Yes.
You know, some 30 years ago, there was a horrible double murder at Hanalei Bay, right here in Kauai. A guy and his girlfriend both got killed, and the girl got abducted. They never found her body until a couple of years ago it surfaced. They found the bones, and they are you familiar with the case? I mean, the bones were found like just a few blocks away from where the boyfriend was, where the crime was committed. They did a DNA. The girl was just a young girl in her early 20s at the time. Mm-hmm. Her father had died. He never knew whatever happened to his daughter. They did a DNA with the family. The mom and the brother are still alive. Are you familiar with that case?
It rings a bell.
How does this relate to the restorative justice call?
There has to be a lot of shame on the North Shore of Hawaii, because eventually so many people knew who did it, but nobody wanted to talk about it. And still, when they uncovered the bones a few years ago and they reopened this investigation, nobody wants to talk about it because of this, like, well, let's let sleeping dogs lie. We don't want to stir up anything. You know what I mean? Let's move on.
Right.
And even though the general consensus, you could ask any number of people, is the main shooter is dead. Mm-hmm. Okay? And can you try dead people? I mean, would you think
No.
it would be important
Yeah.
for the healing process of the North Shore of Kauai to even discuss the murder now that it's even though it's so long ago? Are these cold cases,
yes.
are they important?
Yes, you can.
Lauren, go ahead. And what do you think about that? Caller, thank you. That's interesting.
Okay.
One of our very first projects we did was we developed a restorative practice for victims who don't know who the offender is, or who don't want to meet with the offender. And we developed a restorative practice, and we actually worked with people that, like, one was a murder case. We did work with a guy, a mother. Her son was murdered. Well, the police said it was a negligent homicide, but she said she believed he'd been murdered. Someone had run him off the road on his motorcycle. Another woman had been, there had been an attempted rape.
And this restorative practice we developed, we still use it for people who have suffered. Because it's like actually the Pope just said it the other day when he was talking about Armenia and Turkey. He said something about how, you know, a wound, when you have a wound, if you don't air it out, it just festers. You know, you need to shed light on things.
So,
and talk about things. And, yeah, I think that's really important.
That's great. So this can apply in a lot of different ways. Rich, I heard you want to say something here. We got 5 minutes left. We got to wrap it up pretty quick. What would you like to say in closing there?
Well, you know, I have to leave. In fact, I'm going to have to leave a little bit early. I've got to run to a neighborhood board meeting that I'm chairing. But I think that, you know, just to sum up, I would say, first of all, you know, a shout out, hats off to Lauren for all the fabulous work that she's doing. And the Hawaii Friends of Restorative Justice, I'm so proud and happy and inspired to be part of the organization. And I think that we have to continue to pursue restorative justice. I mean, not only to, you know, to heal these people that are so badly hurt by crimes, you know, the victim and the victim's family and the offenders also, but just as a society, we just cannot afford to put the trillions and trillions of dollars into a prison system, you know, a correctional system that's not working. Mm-hmm. So it's very important for society to continue doing this work. And Rick, I want to thank you so much for giving us a chance to talk and discuss this. And,
you're very welcome.
And Lauren, you too. So
thank
without
you.
Further ado, I'll sign off, if that's okay.
Thank you, Rich. Appreciate that.
Thanks.
And again, people can find you, your organization, at HawaiiFriendsForRestorativeJustice.com.
That's right. That's right.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Well, and thank you for the work that you do. I know that you're donating your time to this cause. And I think as one community member representing many, I appreciate that. So thank you for joining us tonight. We'll wrap up with Lauren. Thank you again, Rich.
Okay. All right. Good. Have a nice evening.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. So, Lauren, now I see that there's a book. There's so much to discuss on this, and we're just kind of scratching the surface on this issue. There are a number of organizations and practices, you know, that are utilizing the values of restorative justice, and mm-hmm. We have another one called Pono Kauliki. We have Ho'oponopono, a lot of different things that are going for the same goal, which is healing and possibly forgiveness. Lauren, there is a book, as I started to mention before, that I understand people are interested in learning more about. It's called Restorative Justice Today, Practical Applications, and that's by Van Wormer and Walker. Lauren, you want to give us your email address and your website address and anything you'd like to say in closing?
Sure, okay. My email address is Lauren, L-O-R-E-N-N, at hawaii.edu or lauren@laurenwalker.com. I would really like to just close and say that I really am on a mission to try to get restorative justice in the schools in our state. I think if we started using restorative justice with children, we would be able to prevent the need for all these prison beds.
Mm.
And, you know, we know that kids who get into the juvenile justice system have drug problems. And we know that kids who develop drug problems have learning problems. So if we could do restorative practices in the schools and identify these things and get people what they need, which, you know, might be remedial educational help. And what the beauty of restorative justice is that it brings in community members. It builds social capital. You bring in people. The lady whose house got graffitied, she'll come in, meet the kid, find out you can't read, volunteer to tutor a couple days a week.
Beautiful.
You know, and so we need to do these in the schools. And I really reach out to any teacher out there that hears this to please contact me. I will help you. I'll help you get a grant.
And your email address again?
It's Lauren at hawaii.edu.
Thank you so much for being my guest here on Out of the Box. I just noticed someone just texted me some information about another avenue in which they're applying this type of thing. You talk about youth peer mediation programs are being available here at Kapa'a High in Kauai, and of course many other places. There's a lot of different facets to this. I'm pledged and committed to sharing more about this issue in the future. Again, my name is Rixey, R-I-C-S-E-A-M-O-U-S-E, and I'm so glad to have been here. Thank you, Jonathan. Again, thank you, Lauren Walker, for being my guest, and Rich Turbin for being on earlier. We will see you. I'll be back in a couple of weeks, I believe, and Jonathan will be here next Thursday on Out of the Box. Thank you again, and good night, Lauren.
Good night. Thank you very much, Rick. Aloha.
Aloha.
Thanks so much for tuning in to KKCR, Kauai Community Radio. This has been another Out of the Box show.